Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Today I'll be talking to a couple of mystery writers. Later in the hour, Reading author Robert Sego will tell us about his combat-hardened private detective and his German Shepherd partner Joker in Tears of the Innocent. And we'll end with a change of pace from North State author and entertainer Shane Weissman. My first guest was editor of the professional film and TV production monthly magazine Post, and the cinematic point of view of his novels owes a lot to his years as a scriptwriter. Ken McGorry and his wife have a little summer place in West Hampton Beach, New York, not far from an old house rumored to have been a brothel and haunted today. His latest novel is Ghost Hampton. Ken McGorry, welcome.
Hi, Nancy.
So you actually know of an old house that is supposed to be haunted?
Yeah, everybody wants to talk about it, but I'm sworn to secrecy, except between you and me.
Well, but I was wondering if that's what gave you the idea for the book.
Yeah, I had written my first book. I'd started a second book, and this was about 5 years ago. Mary and I were driving in West Hampton, and she said, "See that house? I know the guy who bought it, and he told me that it's haunted." And I said, "Really? They still do that?" And she said, "That's what he said. He's not a paranormal guy or anything. His daughters see a girl ghost in their bedroom every night, and they enjoy it."
So it is livable, then. If they're saying in the bedroom every night, then the actual house somebody lives in.
Oh, yeah, real people. That's one reason why I can't talk about it in too great detail.
Uh-huh.
I have some friends who are longtime West Hampton guys who have a little group, of an email group, and they kick around which house it is, which house they are sure it is.
Yeah, because in the book, the house is not in any shape that anybody could live in it. It's quite run down and dilapidated and has unsavory critters living in it.
Yeah, I'm glad you noticed that. Mary and I were driving, and she mentioned this haunting. And then as we were getting out of the car, she said, "Oh, yeah, and it was a brothel way back when." So at that point, I was like, okay, this is my next book. And I already had a title in mind, a two-word title, by the time we get out of the car.
Well, you described, when you're describing the house, you described as a shutter being akimbo. And I latch on to interesting uses of words like that. I don't think I'd ever heard a shutter described as akimbo.
Yeah, I wonder if it's wrong, but it's... Yeah, it's falling apart, and I made it be a Victorian, obviously, and put it in a different town. And I like Bridgehampton. It's right in the middle of the Hamptons, and also in October, it goes down to 3,000 people over the winter after 30,000 population, about 30,000 in the summer.
Well,
so it suddenly becomes a small town.
If readers imagine the Psycho house, the house in the movie Psycho, would they be far off?
Yeah, that's it. They're out there. I saw one in Garden City, another town near us on Long Island that has old homes. And I saw one, and I was like, wow, there it is, except it had a nice paint job and nothing akimbo.
Well, if you've got your book there, let's hear the opening. You know, I have to tell you, I love the opening sentence of your book. You're already playing a trick on us readers with your opening sentence. And, you know, opening sentences are really that you want to grab the reader. And would you read just that opening sentence for us?
Okay. It was the road work on Montauk Highway that made Lyle Hall get the electric chair.
And that's almost gasp-worthy. Lyle Hall, at this point, we don't know he's the main character, but get the electric chair?
Yeah, he had the self-propelled kind that his daughter called the Mr. Potter model from It's a Wonderful Life. Everyone, including his daughter, gives him a hard time for being the Scrooge-like character throughout his career.
So why don't you continue reading there in Chapter 1 for us, Ken?
Since last winter, he'd made do with the self-propelled kind. His daughter Georgie called it the Mr. Potter model. To Lyle, it said temporary. A new electric chair with all the high-end options would say permanent. At 55, Lyle was not ready to say that. He'd made good progress over the spring and summer, strength training his upper body. A perky female physical therapist came to his house in Bridgehampton twice a week. A tattooed trainer guy beat him up on Fridays. Lyle had the stretchy resistance bands and a rack of light dumbbells in embarrassing lavender in the living room. Dangling in the dining room doorway was the Torquemada, a sling-like contraption he used to hoist himself up and perform certain torturous routines. Any
so already,
strain or discomfort he felt was north of his L4 vertebra.
So already we're wondering who this character is, Lyle Hall, who is getting around in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And we don't know yet other than the fact that he has a daughter. We learned that. His daughter's named Georgie. And we learned that he has an injury north of his L4 vertebra. And he doesn't have any feeling from the low back down since killing. So we find out this character has killed a lady.
Yeah.
And it's been about a year since this accident. Would you continue that?
Sure, right there. Lyle had no feeling from the lower back down since killing Elsie Kronk with his stupid Hummer last October, almost a year. Each week he journeyed to Southampton to the spinal injury clinic where they worked miracles. Lyle fully expected them to make him their next miracle, and the team there was so positive and effusive that they kept the dream alive. As professionals, they didn't hold Elsie Kronk against him, but they knew. Everybody knew. Even though Lyle and Elsie and an old duffer walking his dog were the only witnesses, they knew. With his SUV piled up on the war memorial at Bridgehampton's main intersection, windshield wiper spiderwebbed and red, the first responders, busy trying to free the elderly lady from her big old Ford, they initially pronounced him dead. Lyle had a bona fide near-death experience and was comatose for 2 weeks. But few really cared. Elsie was the tragedy. Elsie had been on her way to her son's 50th birthday party. Lyle Hall lived.
So we learn in this first page that he has killed this old lady on her way to her son's birthday party. And I wondered, you've got your main character confined to a wheelchair, and
yeah.
I was wondering, as I read the descriptions of how he manages, where did you research what it's like to be confined to a wheelchair?
No, I didn't want that. I had some people lined up, and I did interview people for Ghost Hampton. I used to interview them all the time. I mean, for my magazine, but various people. But I made a conscious decision to, since Lyle wants this problem to go away, and he's putting all his budget that he has available into specialists of all stripes that you can, everyone you can imagine is working on Lyle's spinal injury. It's something he's embarrassed about. He wants it to go away. He doesn't feel it's the real Lyle or a new normal for him. There are only a couple of times that we, for instance, refer to ostomy bags.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah, that kind of comes as a surprise later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he has euphemisms for everything. So he's in denial, and which rhymes with Lyle. And I felt he's got enough as it is. So if it's not on his mind, then let's move forward. What I wanted was him to be incapacitated and not able to do the things that he wants to do. So his main thing is getting in and out of buildings. That's his drawback.
Well, why don't you continue? Pick up there. We meet another of the characters in the book in the next paragraph.
Yeah. Lyle's weekly visits to Southampton included sessions with Dr. Susan Wayne, a therapist specializing in post-traumatic stress disorder. Her job was to stave off depression, incrementally step down his benzodiazepine dosage, and provide mechanisms to mitigate survivor guilt, which Lyle had, though he didn't admit to it. It wasn't his fault that Elsie blundered into his path, 85 years of age and blinded by the setting sun, cautiously making her overly wide right turn onto Montauk Highway. Who can't execute a simple right on red? In her late husband's aircraft carrier size Ford Futura. And everyone guns it a little, not just Lyle, when Bridgehampton's last traffic light turns yellow. Another damning detail was his destination, a bar in Montauk. Practically everyone believed Lyle was drunk when he collided with Elsie. Incredible how easy it is to believe the worst about somebody. Yeah, he drank, but he wasn't drunk when he hit the sweet old lady with the fresh-baked birthday cake on the seat beside her. He was on his way to get drunk. Huge difference.
And we learned then that it's even sadder that this 85-year-old was killed. My guest is Ken McGorry, and he's reading from his novel, Ghosthampton. As we learn more, we're not sure whether we like this guy or not. I happen to have liked him, and I think the readers do. As I was reading this, I felt like I was watching a movie, and I'm sure it comes natural to you if you were a scriptwriter.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I shifted it into present tense after this introductory chapter, which then irritated other people in the traditional publishing world. So besides my irritating lead character and my first present tense verbs, there is, I don't know, but it's working for readers. The readers have been wonderful. They give Lyle a chance, which was my plea, and they feel like they're watching something, maybe because of the present tense.
Well, why don't you continue the next after he was on his way to get drunk?
Yeah. By the way, he goes out east to Montauk, which is the end of Long Island geographically, but it's also he has no friends in Bridgehampton or any other Hamptons. So it's his kind of the last refuge of the scoundrel out there. That's why I wound up. And he's alone. He's divorced. But so since last year, Lyle's had scant contact with people other than medical professionals, service providers. He spends the most quality time with Fred, the Medicab driver, who's been getting him to his appointments since March. Georgie is also a professional. Just 30, she's a newly promoted Southampton police detective, what she'd always wanted. Trouble is, now that she's thrown herself into her new job, she also has this albatross of a dad. He bluffs that he can do things for himself, but that makes things worse. Her solution is surgical strikes, like dropping off prepared meals that Lyle can microwave. And she makes sure to nag him over the phone, like, take your meds, keep up your hygiene, drink plenty of water, do your exercises, shave off that unbecoming beard, and get a damn electric wheelchair, for God's sake. And Lyle has no one else, certainly not Dar, his Floridian ex-wife. Her role, to play trophy wife to Lyle and wicked stepmother to Georgie during the crucial teenage years following Georgie's mom's death. That ended acrimoniously years ago. So Lyle is Georgie's cross to bear, and it was Lyle, before the accident, back when he was an important lawyer, who twisted one powerful arm to get her promoted to detective. She is abundantly qualified, a master's in forensic psychology and all, but she was still considered a girl entering a man's world. Now she's in a position where the man who made her challenging job possible is also a big daily pain in the ass.
So we learn that this main character, Lyle, was a lawyer.
You just read.
My guest is Ken McGorry, reading from his novel Ghost Hampton. And we learn now that this main character, Lyle, was a lawyer and that his daughter was a police detective. And I was wondering if that is just drawn from your imagination. Did you have any direct contact with getting information of what that kind of job is like?
Yeah, I was really lucky. A friend of mine who is a man and not a blonde 30-year-old woman, he recently retired from being a detective in a smaller town. He originally worked in New York City and then kind of graduated to a detective in a small town. So I got to run everything by him. Mm-hmm. And is this plausible? What would they do here and there? So he's in the back. He's listed in the back of my series of victims who I was nagging for information.
Well, it also comes in handy that your character's daughter is a police detective because at one point in the story, he needs the services of a sketch artist.
Yeah.
And that's gotten quite high tech now. And I was wondering was he the source of information about how a sketch artist works?
I just had an outline, so to speak, of how they work. And what I did was I infused that scene with my knowledge of Photoshop and how people work in animation in the film production world. So I stirred that together into a new character, a young guy who was a good artist and could piece together a face based on Lyle's description. And he also got $200 for doing it. Or something like that.
Well, we have a couple more paragraphs in this first chapter. So why don't you finish up there with Georgie's nagging?
Okay. Georgie's nagging inspired Lyle's spiteful solo excursion. To prove his mettle that day, the day of the road work, he took the Long Island Railroad from Bridgehampton to Southampton. Fred merely dropped him at the station. Later, when Lyle returned on the rush hour train, one of a half dozen travelers disembarking at Bridgehampton, he was visibly exhausted from the day's effort. Fred saw Lyle wheel out of the train car and quickly joined him on the platform to help negotiate the handicap ramp switchbacks leading to the parking area. The whole point had been to show Georgie that he could do stuff on his own, like propelling himself to his appointments in Southampton. The challenge proved otherwise. But Lyle would craftily use his physical meltdown as a cover for making his sudden about-face on the electric chair question. He could withhold the true reason for the new chair, but he'd be unable to withhold what was to follow. The detour took traffic slowly past the abandoned house.
So this is from the novel Ghost Hampton by novelist and former scriptwriter Ken McGorry. And you had a previous book, The Smashed. What was that book?
It is, also has a lot of interviews. It is life and one death in a substance abuse rehab in New Jersey, not far from New York City, 3 years after 9/11. So you see some people who, are suffering from 9/11, from having survived 9/11. Mm-hmm. And they're funny. They attack each other mercilessly in group meetings and such.
So you're true to your style then, even though it's a serious subject.
Yeah. They're males in this. It's a co-ed facility, but they're separated by kind of a wall. So the males get to see some females occasionally, almost like prisoners would. But it's basically guy-on-guy well, ball busting, I think is what they're doing. And it's kind of funny, but it gets to a point where our hero, who is a brand new counselor, has to make a decision.
Well, we mentioned that there's this haunted house that figures in this story. And you mentioned earlier you used the word paranormal. And
yeah.
It doesn't seem like your background would lead us to expect you to be writing about the paranormal, Ken.
No. No, I'm a regular guy.
Yeah.
But I think that my fellow editor at Post Magazine years ago, we were meeting in my office talking about something, and she stopped the conversation and said, "Do you know anything that's black?" And I said, "I must have some black socks." But so I'm just not that way. But what I found, and you'll see it, I think a lot if you listen even at a cocktail party or something, the most interesting stories sometimes are ones that come from, quote, regular, unquote, people who say, "You know what, I never believed in ghosts, but something happened at our new house recently. You wouldn't believe it. I'd like to tell you about it." And you'll hear things that, in my case, make the kind of the hair on the back of the neck stand up. Then in addition to that, I have a niece, an adult niece, who does dabble in the paranormal. And she would take pictures for this website that used video and pictures that no longer exists. And they would use her photos of cemeteries that seemed to have these ghostly things emanating up from the headstones. And she's done her share of ghost hunting.
Well, you have these elements of the paranormal. So at some point, if this lawyer, Lyle, is curious about this old abandoned house and he sees something suspicious, then we expect at some point he's going to want to go inside this house. And it's interesting that he is accompanied by a priest from Malta, and you imitate his speech patterns. And I was curious as to how you chose to have this priest be from Malta.
Yeah, there are exchange priests in the Catholic Church. Our local parish, where I live the rest of the year in Manhasset. So I'm a cliche who lives in Manhasset on Long Island, and then the summer as much as I can in West Hampton, which is about 60 miles away. But so in Manhasset, there's a Catholic church, a lot of Catholics running around Manhasset, and they regularly would have a priest from Malta come and say some masses and be there for the summer, usually. And our Monsignor, that would be the guy in charge, once said, "Oh, yes, well, he's from Malta, and he's very spiritual and mystical." So I was watching this priest, this was years ago, and I was like, "Oh, so that's what spiritual and mystical looks like, huh?" And so for a fictional character, I felt he had to be a heartthrob, an unattainable heartthrob. Mm-hmm. So he's tall and handsome and young and troubled and a good guy. So in a lot of ways, not like the Maltese priest that I met.
My guest is Ken McGorry, and his novel is Ghost Hampton. And you throw in something else that I found amusing. I mentioned that you kind of tricked the reader with your opening sentence. But also you throw in some, we don't know what it is when we first hear it, because you write it out in English words. And it looks like "se pazzo," and another "ai tucci." And you think, what is this odd combination of English words? And then later you spell it out. And I happened to be reading in the next chair was a friend who speaks Italian. And so I said, "What does sei pazzo mean?" And he told me. And I said, "What about aiutucci?" And he knew what that meant, too. So you did a good job of reproducing so that those of us who might not speak Italian could pronounce these strange words that were coming from this abandoned house.
Yeah, thanks. I love words. Different languages are really tough. But a couple of phrases here and there can be fun, at least for a guy like me. And
so
I wanted her to try to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
I wanted her to the apparition to try to communicate with our man Lyle. And I also wanted him to misconstrue what he was saying, which he did. He doesn't hang with 12-year-old dead girls.
Yeah, so when he hears "say pazzo," you write it as he is hearing it, not as she is saying it exactly.
Yeah, he doesn't know what they're saying. That became a good joke for me, because he has to rekindle his relationship with his researcher friend, who he struggled with over the years. The researcher is all about saving properties in the Hamptons, and Lyle is all about tearing them down and building McMansions on top of them. So they haven't gotten along, but he tries to rekindle the relationship, and the researcher says to Lyle, "Lyle, say pazzo." And Lyle says, "Why would I say pazzo?" which is, he's anglicizing or whatever. But it's really, "You're crazy," or "Are you crazy?"
And then that other phrase that he doesn't know what it means, "I tucci."
Yeah.
And
"Help us," and then "help her." That's the "help her." Lyle doesn't understand who the "her" is. He has no way to understand it, and he finds out in the end of the book.
I really enjoyed your novel and the main character, Lyle, and his adventures. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Ken.
Oh, same here, Nancy. I was really looking forward to it. It was my pleasure.
My guest has been Ken McGorry, and his book is Ghost Hampton. After a short break, I'll be talking to Reading author Robert Sego about his latest mystery novel, Tears of the Innocent. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Later in this half hour, Shane Weissman will recite some of his nifty nursery rhymes and twisted tales. Under the name Professor Shane, he writes alternative childhood stories that entertain adults as well as children. Reading native Robert Sego started writing seriously in high school. He joined the U.S. Navy and resumed writing in 2009 with short stories. In 2012, he started his first novella, which ended up being a full-length novel, The Chains That Bind. He has worked in healthcare for 37 years and uses a lot of that experience, as well as his military experience, as material for his writing. He recently finished his third novel, Tears of the Innocent. It will be followed by a sequel, The Rebirth of Innocence, which will debut at the Reading Writers Forum in November. Robert Sego, welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I might mention that you write under the name R.L. Sego.
I do.
And you decided to do that instead of using the name Robert.
Yeah, I have an uncle named Robert, who I was named after. Uh-huh. And he's Robert K. I'm Robert L. And I just liked the R.L. Sego. It just kind of a fan of the R.L. Stine books, you know, even though they're for kids. I can't help it. I'm just a big kid at heart. but I just it kind of had a catchy rhyme to it, and my wife really liked it, so I figured if she's going to go with it, then we'll do it.
Well, you mentioned your wife, a couple of other members of your family that I was amused that you have a couple of Pembroke Welsh corgis.
We do. We've had corgis since 1994. Our first one passed away fairly young from an unknown disease we didn't know she had until we got her. And our second one passed away several years ago from she got a hold of a poison mushroom in our backyard, and unfortunately it was fairly toxic. We picked up two sisters back in shortly after we lost Harley Rose back in 2011. We picked up two sisters for new pups that had been born to a local breeder, very reputable breeder. I believe in nothing but reputable breeders.
Well, I'm not sure I know the difference in a Pembroke Welch Corgi and, say, what the Queen has. Are those the kind of...
They're the same dog. The difference is the Pembroke and the Cardigan. The Pembroke doesn't have a tail. The tail is docked at birth. Mm-hmm. And the Cardigan is a little bit bigger body-wise and has the longer tail. But the Pembrokes are what the Queen has, and we figured if it's good enough for the Queen, it's good enough for us.
Well, you have a dog that figures in your book, and his name is Joker, but he's a German Shepherd.
Correct.
And you have a very nice photograph on the very back cover of your book of a German Shepherd. And so I know that's not your dog since you have corgis.
No, ma'am.
But,
I had a German Shepherd growing up. We like the breed. I try to incorporate dogs into all of my books. My second book, Voices of the Past, I had two dogs featured fairly prominently. A bull terrier and a Pembroke Welsh Corgi, of course. And I like featuring dogs in my books. I think they bring another element of attraction to the book for readers, because many people can have dogs. You know, they can kind of understand my passion for dogs. In fact, I had a reader in my current book. Somebody who bought my current book sent me a text after she finished, and she said, "You know, I really loved the book. It was very good." But she says, "I like Joker," but she says, "You can never kill a dog in your book. Any of your books, no, you cannot kill a dog." And I said, "Okay."
No.
So I had to put that on my board. No killing of dogs in books.
That's right. As a dog lover myself, I don't like those kind of books either.
I don't have the heart to do it. You know, because I was kind of thinking with the sequel, you know, where I was going to go. I took that right off the page. I took that right out of the equation.
Well, you mentioned your previous mystery suspense novel, Voices of the Past, P-A-S-S-E-D,
mm-hmm.
is the name of another book of yours. Now, I want to get back to the cover of your most recent book, Tears of the Innocent.
Yes, ma'am.
Because on the back cover, you have this lovely German Shepherd, and on the front cover, and I love the eyes, the German Shepherd's eyes.
Right.
But also, you have a pair of eyes that are prominently featured on the front cover of your book.
In the young girl, right.
Yeah.
That was kind of the graphic artist that I'm working with, a young lady actually out of London, England. I actually met through a kind of a mutual friend, and I really liked her work. I looked at her webpage, and I sent her some ideas. Okay, this is what the story is about. This is kind of what I'd like to do. Sent her some ideas that I had, and she drew up two or three different designs, sent them back to me, and said, "Okay, what do you like about each one? What don't you like about them?" We kind of went through it, but when I saw this one, It leapt out at me. It was like, oh, okay, this is what we made a couple of very minor tweaks on this cover and back cover. In fact, the dog on the back page was her idea. She actually liked that. I hadn't even thought about the back cover page.
Oh, yeah.
But when I saw this cover that Lindsay had sent me, I was really taken with it. And my wife saw it, and she really liked it. And I've had many readers that have just really, they say that just the eyes just kind of draw you to the book.
Oh, yeah, they grab you. Yeah.
So, you know, that really worked out well, and I'm really pleased with my graphic artist. I'm planning on using her for the sequel that I'm working on right now.
Well, this young girl who is on the cover with these eyes that are just so intense is not the main character, so why don't you introduce us to the main character by reading us some of your prologue.
Okay,
would you do that, Robert?
I can do that. The opening prologue, now it doesn't contain anything to do with, there are several main characters, Ryder Raines, who will be introduced in the prologue, Lacey Devane, who is will become his love interest and becomes very focal to the point of the story, is introduced in chapter one. She's a senior medical examiner in Santa Barbara County. But Ryder is a private detective retired from the San Diego Sheriff's Office, retired and became a private detective up in Santa Barbara. And he only takes the jobs that he wants to take. He and Joker are set well enough, they don't have to do anything other than what they want to do, you know, like many of us probably wish we could be in life. But
so
I've got it open here.
Yeah, you say it starts April 7th, 2015.
Yes, ma'am. April 7th, 2015. Ryder leaned against the hood of his truck, a cigarette between his fingers and the warmth soaking through his jeans, his boots firmly planted on the ground as he stared out at the dark blue waters of the Pacific Ocean. His partner Joker sat on the asphalt next to him, his black nose sniffing the sea air for anything out of the ordinary. In the distance, the waves slowly rolled in the whitecaps, the whitecaps playfully teasing the hardcore morning surfers like a skilled lover, caressing them with a taste of what awaited them if they were patient just long enough. Along the shoreline, a number of people were jogging, several with dogs keeping pace, and Ryder wondered if any of them were even aware of the short-haired man and his canine sidekick observing them. Ryder inhaled deeply of the cigarette as Joker caught wind of something on the air current, indicated by the stiffening of the silver-streaked mane against the dark black coat. Ryder immediately spotted the tension in the dog's appearance and let his eyes begin to scrutinize the area more closely.
So already we see that Joker, this German Shepherd,
right,
and your main character, Ryder, are somewhat of a team of partners because he's paying attention to the dog's reaction.
Absolutely. They're totally in tune with one another. Later in the story, it shows how he ended up with Joker, or how they ended up together, I should say. But he trusts Joker more than anything. You know, they kind of act as one almost. You know, if a human and a dog can be said to do that, they're about as close as they can get.
Well, read us more about Ryder Raines.
Okay, at 39, Ryder Raines was still young at heart and mind, and in remarkably good physical shape. But as his aching joints frequently reminded him, it wasn't the years that were catching up with him; it was the mileage. He always smiled when this thought came to him, feeling as if he was comparing himself to a race car or a thoroughbred horse. He was just shy of 6 feet tall, weighed a compact 190 pounds, had deep-set, piercing brown eyes and short-cropped brown hair, a well-trimmed goatee, and a thin, jagged scar that ran from the right corner of his mouth under his chin at a 45-degree angle across his clavicle and ended just under his shirt collar. Despite the mark, he still maintained the unique gift of being able to blend in anywhere, anytime, without arousing suspicion.
Well, now, I want to pause right there because, you know, everything's going fine. It seems like, well, here's a nice-looking guy. He's almost 6 feet tall. He's must be muscular at 190 pounds. But then, this scar that runs from his mouth under his chin all the way down to his shirt collar.
All the way down.
And that's a shock for us readers when we get to that.
I actually had several people that I had kind of reviewing it before I published it. One said, you know, I don't really think the scar, you know, does anything for the story. And I said, no, you don't understand. The scar is imperative to leading you into the story as to why he has the scar. You don't just end up with a scar like that.
No, that's
shaving
right.
Or
that's right.
You end up with a scar like that from something very bad. And I thought that's kind of what you want to do, is I want to kind of pique their interest and say, well, why does he have this big scar? You know, like you said, he's very, you know, 6 foot tall, 190, muscular, sounds like he's a nice-looking man.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden, he's got this ugly, thin scar running down across his neck and under his shirt. Okay, well, good. That means that they'll keep reading. And that's what's important to me. I want to keep the people that buy my books, I want to keep them intrigued. I want to keep them thinking, okay, what's he going to do next? What's he going to do next? Where are we going next?
And where did he get that scar?
Right, exactly. You know,
there's got to be a story there.
The whole thing, and it does eventually, you know, in this book, go into, you know, how he got the scar and the whole story behind it, which kind of feeds into the main body of the story, you know. I thought it was originally, I wasn't sure, but I just thought, no, I need to have something to kind of keep, you know, to kind of pique people's interest. Go, okay, why does he have the scar? What does the scar have to do with anything? At least, if people ask why, then they're going to want to read on to
find the answers.
See what happened. How did he get the scar? Why does he have the scar? You know, it just seemed like it made good sense at the time. And so far, I think I'm pleased with the way it's turned out.
Well, I mentioned that you have worked in healthcare for going almost 40 years.
Yes, ma'am.
And that you draw on that experience. And of course, you have your military experience. You were in the Navy. And to what degree, what elements did you draw on when you were writing this story? Because, for example,
probably more along as it relates to Ryder, because as his character develops in the story, you'll see that he himself was a Navy corpsman, much like myself, served time during the Iraq and Afghanistan conflict, and that's what kind of turned him into the man he has become over, you know, through life-changing events that have happened from that point, from the time he joined until the time he retired from the sheriff's office. You know, I spent 5 years as a Navy corpsman, so I use a lot of that in my previous book, Voices of the Past. To digress just a moment, the main character in that, Caleb Armstrong, is also a former Navy corpsman who has become a nurse working in San Diego. I think that experience, life experience, gives you a lot of material.
Yes.
And I think if you don't utilize that, I think you're making a bad mistake. I mean, whether it's, you know, healthcare, whether it's driving a truck, being a police officer, a teacher, I think it gives you a tremendous amount of experience. And if you don't utilize that, I'd like to utilize it in my characters to help develop them into people that people can relate to, my readers can relate to, and go, oh, okay, yeah, I was a corpsman way back in the, you know, in the 80s. I remember, oh, yeah, I served in Afghanistan. It's something they can relate to. And I think that, if you, again, if you can do that, you keep them interested in the book.
My guest is Robert Sego. He is a Reading native, and he goes by the on his books, he uses the name R.L. Sego. And we're talking about his current novel, his most recent novel, Tears of the Innocent. And you have this main character whom you describe as a combat-hardened private detective with this ghastly scar that we wonder, how in the world did he get that? And so he seems like a tough guy, but yet he has this a heart that knows how to appreciate a wonderful dog.
Right.
And that makes him also more lovable, if I want to use that word, to those of us who
understand. Sure, I think that works.
Well, this book is just... is not the final book in this series. You plan to write a sequel to this book.
Yes.
And I think it's helpful to know that because when you're reading along and you get to the last page of this book, so we know who Joker is.
Right.
He's this German Shepherd.
Right.
And why don't you read that very last paragraph?
Okay. Outside in the hallway, Joker stood, hackles raised, his dark eyes locked on Micah, then back to the room. A low, dangerous growl emanating deep in his throat as the boy stared into the bedroom.
Now, Robert, that does not sound like the end of a story.
No, oh, no. and that's what I had to figure is, okay, where do I take it from here? You know, the first few people that bought copies of this, really, I've got really good reviews from them, and the common thread other than, you know, really enjoying the book was, okay, when is the next one coming out?
Yeah, because when you read that story, you think, well, gosh, instead of everything being wrapped up,
right. We've
got this, the dog is growling at something. So there you've piqued our interest in your next book.
And I wasn't really sure when I finished this one. I had several endings to this one that I kind of worked with this one, worked with that one, kind of had my wife look at them. She's a great sounding board and a great editor. And she really liked the way this one, there was an alternate ending that also could have taken into the sequel. I liked a little better, but she thought it might give away too much.
Well, I'd like to remind people the name of that one. They can look for the sequel, The Rebirth of Innocence.
Yes,
it's been a pleasure.
In November.
Yes, been a pleasure talking to you, Robert, about Tears of the Innocent.
Well, Nancy, I appreciate you taking the time. It means a great deal to me to be able to promote my books. They're available at Amazon.com, or you can contact me at Facebook, facebook.com/RLSego.
Thank you, Robert.
Nursery rhymes are a staple of childhood, but my guest, Shane Weissman, has written a book that shows that nursery rhymes can entertain adults as well as children. He spins grown-up humor into many familiar children's stories. His collection of rhymes and stories feature alternative twists on childhood stories like Jack and Jill, Pinocchio, Humpty Dumpty, Captain Kirk, and Rapunzel. Under the name Professor Shane, he visits schools in the North State and reads from his book, Nifty Nursery Rhymes and Twisted Tales. Shane Weissman, welcome.
Hi.
Well, there are pictures that I saw of you in classrooms when you travel around, and often the person coming to entertain the children is in costume. And in your photograph, you're dressed in a coat and tie, and the children are in costume. How do you do that?
Well, I wear a suit and tie because of other purposes, but I guess it adds a surprise dignity to the work, so it makes it look like I'm really a professor.
Yeah, because you're presenting yourself as, and in your author's name, you use Professor Shane. But where do you get those Dr. Seuss hats that the children are wearing?
Well, that was something that the class was doing probably for Dr. Seuss Day. Uh-huh. And so I tell everybody that my grandfather was Dr. Seuss, and you can tell I have a twin brother, Dr. Phil. And
you do
and
look
so
like,
I go by Professor
Sheen.
You
might mention that you do resemble him physically, Dr. Phil. Yeah. So that's why you say that. Well, they have on these big Dr. Seuss hats, and they have little whiskers drawn on their faces. And so they're already feeling a festive mood before you even walked in the classroom.
Right. And teachers have found sometimes they'll get parents to come in to support reading. It's so good for children to read, and Dr. Seuss was fun. And children would anticipate what the next sound's going to be. That's half the fun in poetry. And they'd get people to come in with absolutely no enthusiasm. And so when they can get someone in, it gets the kids wound up and the kids love to read, even ones who may not have had much interest in reading now, see how fun words on a page can be.
Well, you say that the children come in maybe not so thrilled about having poetry or nursery rhymes recited to them. But were you? What were you like when you were a school kid?
I remember I was about the third grade, and we'd have one class, one teacher for all subjects, and okay, time for singing, everybody, and we might know the songs, but I would be able to change the words that rhyme on the fly, and all the kids around me would laugh, and the teacher would walk around trying to see what's wrong, and I was a good student. She didn't think it was me, and I sounded like I was singing normally, but I could change all the words around to where the song is now silly, and I've kind of taken these stories and just basically changed them so great that now people aren't ever sure which way is the real way that Pinocchio should end, or Rapunzel, or Rip Van Winkle.
So when you would be singing songs when you were a school kid, and you would put in a substitute words that rhymed, so they rhymed.
Yes.
And so that's another reason the teacher was unsuspecting.
Right. And when a whole group of people singing and just three have the words wrong, but the rhyme still has the same sound as the correct word, it's really hard for her to catch on.
Well, what is it that you enjoy when you go into a classroom? What is it that appeals to you?
I can usually just reach the heart of everybody. I talk to kids generally, and anytime I have any size audience, no matter how adult they are, if you talk to the youngest ones, you have everybody in the room. And I've had many times a teacher would have me come in for a 15-minute gig, you could say, and then she would say, oh, can you go longer? I mean, because I'd have the attention of the class, and I could go, you know, an hour, whatever. And the kids will love it. They hate when I go. And, Chris, you want to leave them hungry and wanting more.
Yeah, well, now, when you go, because you have a book, and I might remind listeners that the name of your book is Nifty Nursery Rhymes and Twisted Tales. And you say sometimes the teacher wants you to go on for an hour. Do you have enough material memorized that you could go for an hour?
Yes. Matter of fact, Roald Dahl wrote a book years ago called Revolting Rhymes. It's got a few words that you really wouldn't want kids to hear. But I was able to not only commit those to memory, but fix them in a way, and then you write my own book in my own style with many of the stories that he neglected to write. For instance, he wrote an excellent story on Goldilocks or the Three Pigs. And I can kind of go through the way I've changed it a little bit. For instance, the animal I really dig above all others is the pig. Pigs are noble. Pigs are clever. Pigs are courteous. However, now and then to break this rule, you'll meet some pig who is a fool. Tell me what the wolf would say if striding through the woods one day right there in front of him he saw some pig who built his house of straw. The wolf was hot, licked his lips. He says, that pig has had his chips. Little pig, let me come in. No, no, my hair's my chin, chin, chin. Then I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house in. The little pig forgot to pray, so wolf just blew his house away. Then shouted, bacon, pork, and ham. Oh, what a happy wolf I am. And though he ate that pig quite fast, he carefully kept the tail till last. Wolf wandered on, a trifle bloated. Surprise, surprise, for soon he noted a second little house for pigs, but this one had been built of twigs. Little pig, let me come in. No, no, but here's my chinny chin chin. Then I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house in. The second pig began to squeal. He shouted, wolf, you've had one meal. Why don't we talk and make a deal? The wolf said, no, not on your Nelly. And soon that pig was in his belly. Two juicy little pigs, wolf cried, and still I'm not satisfied. I know full well my stomach's bulging, but oh, how I adore indulging. So tiptoeing quietly as a mouse, the wolf approached another house, a house that also had inside a little piggy trying to hide, but this one, piggy number three, was bright and brainy as can be. No straw for him, no twigs or sticks. This piggy built his house of bricks. Little pig, let me come in. No, but here's my chinny chin chin. Then I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house in. You'll need, pig said, a lot of puff, and I don't think you've got enough. Wolf huffed and puffed and blew. That house stayed up as good as new. If I can't blow you down, Wolf said, I'll need to blow you up instead. I'll come back in the dead of night and blow you up with dynamite. You brute, Pig cried. I should have known. Then picking up the telephone, he dialed as quickly as he could the number of Red Riding Hood. Hello, she said. Who's calling who? Oh, hello, Piggy. How do you do? I'm absolutely stupefied, the frightened little pig replied. I know you've dealt with wolves before, but now I've got one at my door. My darling pig, she said, my sweet, that's really something on my street. I've just begun to wash my hair, but when it's dry, I'll be right there. Next comes striding through the wood, little brave Red Riding Hood. The wolf was there, his eyes ablaze and yellowish like mayonnaise. His teeth were sharp, his gums were raw, and spit was dripping from his jaw. The small girl smiles, one eyed flickers. She whips a pistol from her knickers. She swings up above her head, and clunk, clunk, she pounds him dead. Standing in the window stood the pig. Well done, Miss Riding Hood. But piglets, they should never trust young ladies from the upper crust. For now, Red Riding Hood, one notes, not only has two wolfskin coats, but as she goes from place to place, she has his pigskin traveling case.
My guest is Shane Weissman, and he is not reading from his book, and most readers read what they have written. This was totally recited without any notes, and it's a shame that listeners can't see what you're doing as you are reciting this story. And you managed to work in...
The gestures adds life to it, doesn't it?
Yes,
and so
yes.
I end up usually getting the entire group. And I used to go to the bookstore when they'd have open mic poetry night, and people would read their volumes, Death, Hate, Death, and Murder, and everything would be sad. And then I would start, and it'd be lighthearted, but I wasn't reading anything. And then people in the shopping aisles would come, and there'd be 40 or 50 people standing around. Then when it was other people's turn, the audience would weed back out, and then it would fill back up again anytime I had something fun.
Well, because since you're not having to look down at something written, you can look at the people who are listening to you, and I'm sure you have their full attention.
Yes, and I'll put their names right in the story sometimes because I know I need a two-syllable word coming up, and they have a two-syllable name, or I can reduce it, and that's fun to do.
Let me remind people the name of your collection, Nifty Nursery Rhymes and Twisted Tales, and you are a traveling show. You take your show on the road.
Apparently so.
So you go to schools. Mm-hmm. And how wide an area do you serve?
Well, I've gone probably as far north as Dunsmuir and Mount Shasta.
Because you live north of Redding yourself.
Yeah,
you live
in Shasta Lake, which is real close. It's a Redding suburb. And often to Corning and apparently today Chico.
So you travel around to schools and recite your poetry. Now, you managed to work in another story into the Three Little Pigs. You got Goldilocks in there on the scene.
Oh, sure.
And all this comes from your imagination.
Right. Yeah, and in that one, I pretty much stole from Roald Dahl. But in my own, I have them. Like, for instance, with Jack and Jill, I can mix other stories together. Like, two parents had a girl named Jill who lived on top of Wall Street Hill. Their neighbors had a boy named Jack quite next door. He lived in back. Excuse me, I forgot to say, my story's not about today. Let me in my small digression. It's before the Big Depression. Though most kids had no cash to balance, Jack and Jill each got allowance. With most kids, money, kids are rash. 5 minutes time, they blow their cash. But Jack and Jill weren't like the rest. They felt it wisest to invest. But invest where? We need advice. So they approached these three blind mice. The three mice said, now, if you please, you should buy up stocks of Swiss cheese. So Jill wrote down the things they said. Jack asked Jill where her thoughts led. She answered, well, there's time today. Let's write down what some others say. They asked around, made quite a list. Too long to tell, but here's the gist. When they approached two bearded duffers, they said, buy up candle snuffers. One French girl put down her crochet and said, invest in fish fillet. Also, they asked one cool joker who said that he knew a broker who was known as the insider. Brother to Miss Muffet Spider. So without further reflections, Jill wrote down all those directions. They ran 2 miles to the spot, but only found a vacant lot. Though Jack was angered, Jill just cried. I'll bet that stupid joker lied. Jill looked at Jack, and then she said, don't move, there's something by your head. As Jill got close to scrutinize, this thing stared back with bloodshot eyes. The spider was just dangling there and nearly touching Jack's dark hair. He said, I'm Harry, who are you? We're Jack and Jill, how do you do? Since he noticed they were nervous, he asked, can I be of service? Jill asked him, where can we invest to get so rich that we can rest, then never need to work at all, but just go shopping at the mall? Oh, yeah, Jack said, that's just the thing. Then I'd be treated like a king. The spider said if they were wise, they'd do just what he would advise. The best investment you can make is give me cash, which he did take. Would you believe that he was loyal and bought Jack stocks of whale oil? And to Jill, the spider gave 10,000 stocks of Bremishave. Those stocks increased her share of cash until the day the market crashed. Then Jack read that his stocks were down, and that is how he broke his crown. And all too soon the time arrived that even Jill's investments dived. If the stock market you would play, here's my suggestion for today. Give me your money, small or large. I take Visa and Master Charge.
My guest is goes by the name of Professor Shane when he performs, recites. It's hard to pigeonhole what you do. He was reciting from Nifty Nursery Rhymes and Twisted Tales. Now, you threw in a mention of Burma Shave. And I know little kids would not have a clue what you're talking about, but it brought back memories of for me when I was a child and would be traveling to visit my grandmother and see Burma Shave signs on the side of the road.
And that gets people interested in what's the stock market and the crash and the depression, and they can start. And so I want to take something in history to make the story old and yet try to make it relevant for today. And so you can do that with really anything.
Well, I know from when I was younger that little kids love to hear the same story over and over and over till the parents just about, well, and you have it memorized. But it sounds like from what you're saying,
this is the book that the grandparents want to read to the kid over and over again. Hey, let's read this one again.
I was just going to say that what you've written, adults would say, I want to hear that again, Shane.
Sure.
I'm sure they could do their version, but I don't think many of them could bring it to life.
But it's easy to read because I have the pentameter, very natural. Dr. Seuss, really, it is easy to read. It has you know the pace, and the pace here is almost invariable, and you can kind of anticipate what's going to happen. And some of these I've worked on a lot of times, and the way you speak isn't the way you write.
So when you write
something and then I recite it, I would naturally change the words around, and I've adjusted it so that it's easy to read. But my wife and I were in a restaurant, and we were right by a bank of windows. And while I was talking to her, all the windows went red. So I looked. Well, there was a giant Coca-Cola delivery truck with a big red trailer making the windows look red for a moment. And then a moment later, the windows went blue. And I looked, and there was a Pepsi truck. And I happened to know that the Pepsi employees hate Coca-Cola employees and vice versa. And they even sabotage their products in the store. And I thought, oh, that would make a really good story. And my wife, Carla, suggested, hey, why don't you make a rhyme about it? In about 20 minutes, I ended up having this story. Two brands of cola drivers each saw one parking space, and thus a competition was started this odd race. For both conglomerations had been at odds for years. Coke hated Pepsi-Cola, hated them to tears. No love is lost for Pepsi, who eats Coca-Cola too. Each thinks their product's perfect, which should each haul out to you. Each truck could not maneuver, as neither man would yield. If either one would back up, he'd open up the field. They both rolled down their windows to holler out some threats. The Coca-Cola driver had the finest epithets. You're such a stupid fellow, you must have epilepsy. To take a job so low in life, you'd even drive for Pepsi. And the two of them got really mad. They both thrashed on their throttles. Their bumpers played a push-to-row, which shook their loads of bottles. Now one third saw the space, but since they were distracted, he hopped the curb and squeezed right in, although a bit compacted. He looked at them, and then he said, to you I raise my cup. Pepsi and Coke were both quite shocked. His truck read 7-Up.
I did want to ask you about something that you have in common with James Earl Jones. James Earl Jones has this wonderful theater voice. He's a wonderful actor. And he, today, you would never know what he went through as a child. What is it that you have in common with James Earl Jones?
Well, I didn't know that he had this, but I stuttered terribly. I stuttered so hard that at one time I remember giving a comment to a question. It took me 30 seconds to say two one-syllable words, and that's painful for people to listen to.
Your nursery rhymes and your twisted tales are just delightful. Thank you, Shane Weissman.
Thank you.
I would also like to thank mystery writers Ken McGorry, author of Ghost Hampton, and R.L. Sego, author of Tears of the Innocent. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.